opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. When Israel's then Foreign Minister Ariel Sharon took Texas Governor George Bush on a helicopter tour of the Holy Land in December of 1998, Bush was an untested rookie in U.S. politics. Sharon was a might-be dinosaur in Israel. But last year on the campaign trail, Bush said something had clicked between them. You can imagine, he told the Jewish American audience, what it was like to be given a history lesson by this great warrior and hero of freedom and democracy. That was before Ariel Sharon went to the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, setting out the present wave of violence, and before Sharon confounded all reports of his political death by trouncing his peacenik opponent and taking the prime ministership with a record margin of victory. Sharon's stormy history and his chance to rise above it are now the first urgent assignment, or part of it, for the Bush foreign policy team. We're talking about the new government in Washington's reaction to the new government in Jerusalem. Does anybody have an outline of a Bush 2 plan for peace in the Middle East? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Middle East connection. Joining us from New York is Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. Syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer joins us from Washington, and the writer Bernard Avishai from Boston. Mr. Avishai has been covering Israeli elections since 1973. He's the author most recently of A New Israel. Gideon Rose, get us started. It's not as if this Bush team, people like Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush himself, didn't know something about the Middle East and hadn't seen Sharon coming. Do they have a plan?
Well, their plan almost certainly is to take a big step backwards from the Arab-Israeli peace negotiations, both because they didn't like the way they were going and because they have other fish to fry. They might, however, be dragged back in against their wishes down the road should things heat up over there. And the interesting question for me is whether, when they do come back in and play a role perhaps a few months down the road, whether it might be a different role than people think, i.e. reining in the new government on Israel rather than egging it on.
Interesting. Go back to this matter of other more important fish to fry. Donald Rumsfeld is quoted saying that the final settlement in the West Bank is not the most important priority either for the Bush administration or even for the region. What is he talking about?
Well, there are a lot of critics of the Clinton administration's engagement with the peace process, both on the U.S., the Israel-Syria tracks and the Israel-Palestinian tracks. But those critics had very different agendas. One group of critics was annoyed at the amount of time and effort the Clinton administration spent because they thought that that time and energy could and should be spent better on other issues. Either they didn't care about the peace process that much, or they cared about things in the region like Iraq or missile defense or other kinds of issues more. But two other sets of critics were opposed to the Clinton administration's efforts because, for very different reasons, because they cared greatly about the peace process. Some felt the Clinton administration was wrong in pushing for a comprehensive peace agreement. They agreed with the Israeli right. And some felt the Clinton administration was pushing the Israelis and the Arabs too much, and they agreed with the Arab critics. So basically, the Bush administration is going to take a step back because everybody agrees that the Clinton administration was too aggressive, but the reasons for that are very different. And so when those internal camps start to fight, things might get interesting.
The Bush team, as we say, I mean, has its own histories, and I'm sure they've written reams of policy papers back and forth for each other. I mean, I'm thinking of Condoleezza Rice particularly, but Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld. What do we know about their minds on the Middle East?
Well, the first answer is most of the things they wrote and most of the track record and experience they've had were in very different situations, both in a Cold War context and in a situation in the peace process when there was no real prospect of peace and we didn't have the history we've just had. So it's very hard to predict going forward. The biggest divide, I'd say, was not just personalities, but essentially what you could call the old Bush, old Reagan divide, or the realist or ideological divide. In other words, there are people who don't care all that much about trying hard to make the region a better place because they think other things are more important, or they don't think the payoffs for active engagement are all that great. and they're pragmatic because they don't want to get involved, but they don't have a strong set of beliefs about the region. There are other people in the administration who care very much and, in effect, support the new Israeli government's position in the negotiations. And that, again, all sides can agree on stepping back right now. But let's say if the crisis boils up again because there's further terrorism from the Palestinian side against Israel, or a severe crackdown from the Israeli government against that, or more settlement activity, there will be divisions about whether to crack down on either the Palestinians or the Sharon administration. And there's where I think the internal divisions within the administration, perhaps with state and NSC on one side being more willing to criticize the Sharon government, and perhaps the vice president's office and Defense Department being a little bit more supportive.
What's the risk, in your view, of a crackdown by Sharon types in terms of smashing houses or the Intifada? A crackdown so severe that the United States would be cracking down on the crackdown?
Well, that's the interesting question. The ball really at this point is in Arafat's court. The Israelis decisively rejected the Barak program, largely because no one believed that Israel had a serious negotiating partner. Sharon is not going to make a particularly dovish line at this point. And so what remains to be seen is what Arafat will do and the Palestinians will do. My hunch is that, although it's the wrong move, they will step up the violence rather than step up their peace initiatives. And at that point, I think the Sharon administration might crack down hard, and that's when the region could heat up. And that's also the point at which the peace process starts to intersect with other U.S. goals in the region. We're trying very hard to reinvigorate the sanctions against Iraq. We're trying very hard to get lower oil prices. We're trying very hard to concentrate on missile defense and other issues. All those kinds of things require the support of Arabs, Arab states of various kinds. And if Israel becomes a distraction, if the conflict in among Israelis and Palestinians gets so heated that many of our Arab allies and friends are getting very annoyed, the Bush administration might feel obliged to try to rein in the Sharon government.
Charles Krauthammer, read the Bush team, if you can, with respect to the Middle East, and tell us what you think they ought to be caring about.
Well, I think that Gideon's analysis is very accurate. You really do have a split between what he called them correctly, ideologues and realists. Now, generally speaking, a Bush foreign policy, looking back to the father's foreign policy, and much of his team is taken from them, believe that they're not terribly interested in the fine points, as Bill Clinton was, in which streets in the old city will be controlled by which side. They're much more interested in the Persian Gulf and much more interested in stability vis-a-vis Iraq, and they're much more worried about, for instance, Iraq and Iran. And they have no particular stake in the details of a settlement. What they want is relative quiet, and I think that is their strategic aim right now. That's all they really want, and I think it's very realistic, because if we've learned anything from the tenure of the Barak, anything from actually the last 7 years of the Oslo process, it is that peace is an illusion. What Barak offered was certainly as far as Israel could go, although he was rejected, so it actually implies it's further than Israelis are willing to go. And yet Arafat not only rejected it, he never made a counteroffer, and then he started a guerrilla war. So what you find is everyone in the region understands, particularly overwhelming numbers of Israelis as expressed in the election, understand that the idea of a peace, at least right now at this point in history, is completely out of the question. All we're looking at right now is perhaps a series of armistices, and that will be the goal of the Bush administration, to try to get an armistice that will hold at least for a while.
Is that enough?
Enough is what history will allow. It's precisely because people were saying it's not enough over the last 7 years that we have plunged ourselves headlong into this Oslo process, which turned out to be not only an illusion, but destabilizing. What we have now in Israel and the territories is a situation far more unstable than we've had in the last 15 or 20 years, with an armed insurrection, essentially. And Arafat in a position right now, as Gideon indicated, since he's in the driver's seat, if he decides he wants to escalate the conflict, he can very easily bring it to a point where we are on the brink of a regional war. We have not been on the brink of a regional war, or even near it, in 25 years.
Do you think we are today?
I think we can be, and I think Arafat...
I'm sorry, we cannot be?
We can be, yes. Arafat's dream has always been to trigger the regional war, which would overwhelm Israel. That's been his strategic objective ever since his days as a guerrilla in Jordan and in Lebanon. Because he knows that he himself, Palestinians...
Who says that's his strategic objective?
He doesn't say it openly, but clearly what he would like, since his people cannot overcome Israel themselves, if he could trigger a regional war, like a replay of 48, this time with more sophisticated Arab states with much more highly developed militaries and industries, they could prevail. So he's in a position where, as Gideon indicated, if he wants to ratchet up the violence and provoke a Sharon response that could easily bring in Hezbollah in Lebanon, which would bring in Syria, which could bring in Iraq, which could even bring in Egypt.
Charles Krautheimer, stand by. Bernard Avishai, you are in Jerusalem on Election Day. Is peace out of the question in the Sharon era?
Well, first I'd like to greet my friend Charlie Krauthammer, my old classmate. Agree with him that the real problem here is escalation. I don't think it makes a lot of sense for us to begin to, delve into the minds of people based on the results that their actions, finally lead to. We know that there is a process of escalation in the West Bank. We know that, based on the kinds of responses the Palestinian community has manifested in the last little while, we could have an escalation that would lead to regional conflict. Whether this was all along, some Machiavellian plan seems to me somewhat beside the point. Right now, the American government has a choice, and that is to allow that escalation to continue, or to make clear that it is going to put some kind of resources behind stability. Because right now, the trigger is there, and the explosives are there. It's just a question of, someone pulling it.
What's the Sharon mandate in this scene?
Well, his mandate is that when a rifle is fired from Ramallah, then the rifle is responded to with a tank, and that's pretty much what he said was his plan to cope with violence on the West Bank. And that has a certain cycle that we can easily anticipate. If rifles fire from Ramallah or from Beit Jala and tanks respond and start bringing down the first row of houses, the second row of houses, you begin to have a Balkan-type situation, a Lebanon-type situation, which will lead to more rifles firing from more parts of the West Bank. I mean, you have to remember the Hebrew University, for example, which I visit regularly, is on a salient between two Arab villages. The Oslo process has, and this is one of the tragedies of it, has in fact allowed for...
Bernard Avishai, excuse me, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll pick up that thought. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. In the second hour of The Connection, Boston's Dr. Judah Folkman had an idea.
Start Jerusalem and the response by the new Bush government in Washington. We're talking with Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, the columnist Charles Krauthammer, and the writer and business consultant Bernard Avishai. Bernard Avishai, you were just speaking about a sort of a series of escalations that, I mean, these weren't your words, but I mean, that could make a Sarajevo of Jerusalem pretty quickly.
Well, that's exactly the danger. I just want to complete the point about Oslo. One of the tragedies of Oslo is that it was you know, something like a 5-foot leap over a 6-foot pit. I mean, you had here the arming of, at least with light arms, of the Palestinian community on the assumption that the old Fatah leadership would be able to keep order in the West Bank. But the trouble is that when you give small arms to keep order in the West Bank, you're also allowing for Fatah to wage war from the West Bank. And let's assume, which I think is actually an arguable point, but let's assume that the Palestinians are committed to such a guerrilla war right now. Their ability to snipe at Israel from its various towns means that the only Israeli response which Sharon has been promising, which people plausibly believe he'll follow through on, is using heavy arms against West Bank towns. This is ultimately going to lead to more refugees, escalation of the conflict, just like in Lebanon, lots of refugees going over the Jordan River. You could have a complete destabilization of the Jordanian regime, which has 1.5 million Palestinians in camps already. And, you know, does the Bush administration really want to deal with the Middle East in which, you know, the Jordanian government is in a state of collapse? The West Bank is in a guerrilla war. The Egyptians are repudiating the Oslo agreements. You know, this is a serious business here.
How would you get their attention if they said, listen, we're looking at oil prices and the Persian Gulf, and we're detaching this sort of Clinton hovering mother process?
Well, you know, Bush's father could not seem to provide any kind of attention to the Balkans when, you know, in 91, some kind of international force might have been able to preclude a tragedy there. The truth is, I think the way you try to get their attention is just logically, you know, saying what people on the ground in Jerusalem know, and that is the situation is very volatile.
Gideon Rose,
please.
Here? I may be a crazy optimist. I mean, I still think the NASDAQ is going to come back, but I just don't see the prospects for any kind of wider regional war here that the other guests do. I mean, I think what's going to happen, if it does happen, and probably is likely, is a stepping up of the violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians, probably more terrorism, probably more crackdowns. And I think it'll be tragic for the Israelis and most of all for the Palestinians, who, because they're the weaker party, will bear the brunt of any violence. But I find it extremely hard to imagine any kind of broader regional Arab-Israeli war, simply because the other Arab states have very little interest in such a war. Wars don't start accidentally in general. And because the Israelis are so strong, they're weak against a local internal enemy with small light arms, because no one's good at occupying a hostile territory.
That's the point.
But I don't see how the Arab-Israeli, I don't see how the Israeli-Palestinian new intifada connects with any larger conflict. I don't see Iraq coming into war. I don't see Syria fighting a war. Israel could easily deal with its external enemies. What it can't deal with is the internal people.
Charles Krauthammer.
Let me offer a scenario, which I think is a plausible one. First of all, wars do start accidentally. World War One was hardly intended. The Six-Day War was hardly intended. It was a series of mistakes on the part of Egypt and Syria. An easy way in which this can be triggered is for Hezbollah, which is now entrenched in southern Lebanon, with Katyushas aimed, reaching all the way to the suburbs of Haifa, responding in sympathy with some kind of massacre or some kind of large incident on the West Bank with a cross-border attack. Now, Barak himself, the super dove, had pledged that if there were a border attack after Israel had withdrawn to the internationally recognized line, as it did in compliance with UN resolutions, he pledged that if that happened, there would be an attack and the address would not only be Lebanon or Hezbollah, but Syria. That is the only real deterrent Israel has against a serious threat in the north. If that happens, what you have then is a massive Israeli attack, perhaps on Syria and the troops in Lebanon. And you could easily have, again, unplanned and premeditated a major war breaking out, with Iraq sending its troops into or through Jordan in sympathy as well. You could easily have a regional explosion. And I would argue, and here I'm echoing the views of Ehud Yari, one of the most informed and experienced Israeli experts on Arab affairs, who's known Arafat for 20 years, who insists that Arafat has always attempted to trigger this kind of regional conflict in the hope that it would be the way to overcome Israel, he being the weaker party.
Could I ask you all to, and maybe to be the cockeyed optimist myself, but to step back here, the Israeli voters who overwhelmingly rejected Ehud Barak knew, I'm taking this from a fascinating piece by Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Israeli voters knew when they went to the polls that they were not saying no to peace, much less choosing war. The first sounds out of Ariel Sharon as prime minister are of not only a coalition with Labor, but exploration with the Arabs and the Palestinians specifically that would rise above his old reputation. What is the chance in terms of popular pressure and Sharon's own mission here, Bernie Avishai, of a peace direction in the new government?
Well, look, I think it's somewhat misleading to say that this was an overwhelming defeat of Barak. I mean, first of all, if you look at some of the demographic results, Barak actually won Tel Aviv, won Haifa. You know, you have
Walter
to think,
Mondale won Minnesota.
Right. Well, you have to sort of play this out. I mean, the Israeli... You can't look at the Israeli electorate, personify it like, you know, a single personality sort of hovering between dread and wishful thinking and sort of now the Palestinians are doing this and that, so you respond this or that way. I mean, Israel is divided into basically five tribes. There's the sort of Moroccan working class, which has always been pro-Likud no matter what. You have the institutional orthodox, always pro-Likud no matter what. And they came out and they were pro-Likud again. You have the Tel Aviv elites, the educated European types, the people who run 80% of the country, really, who have always been pro-Barak, pro-labor, pro-peace, and they were this time as well. You had the Israeli Arabs who, because of the crackdown by Israeli police on Israeli Arabs in the early part of the Intifada, did not vote this time, and they would have voted for Barak. So you know, almost a million people who would have voted Barak didn't. I mean, this is somewhat of an exaggeration, but that's the fact. The middle part of this group, the Russians, another tribe, the fifth tribe, also about a million people, are the real swing voter here. And they are, you know, very torn right now. They don't want to join the institutional Orthodox. Many of them aren't even Jewish. And yet, they also don't want to get pushed around by the Palestinians. And they're the ones who really swung the election this time, and the Israeli Arabs didn't vote at all. The next elections could be quite different. Now, insofar as, you know, who rejected what, I think it is very possible that Sharon will be able to cobble together some national unity government now. I don't necessarily think that'll lead to a reinvigoration of the Oslo process, though, even if the architect of the Oslo process, Shimon Peres, is part of the government. Because the real question is whether this coalition that Sharon is sitting on could respond positively to the kinds of concessions, particularly around Jerusalem, which Barak and Tel Aviv were prepared to make. And, you know, this is a fight for the soul of Israel that's going to go on for the next 30 years, as it has gone on for the last 30 years.
What about the fight for the mind of Ariel Sharon? Charles Krauthammer or Gideon Rose?
Well, I think his mind has been rather made up for a long time, and I think he's not... People talk about him as a great warrior. Clearly, Israel, as a country, has not the slightest interest in war. Ehud Barak had no interest in the Intifada. Clearly, this the fighting that we've had since September has been a strategy of sorts of the Palestinians to force better conditions, to force more concessions, and perhaps to trigger a wider war. Israel has no interest in that, so its interest is deterrence. And I think the real issue in this election, I disagree with Bernie, I think when you lose an election by 25 points, when you do worse than either Barry Goldwater or George McGovern, you have suffered a decisive, overwhelming defeat, and the country has spoken. And what it had said is, we will not countenance this kind of process in which we make huge concessions and in return receive not only nothing, not only a counteroffer, but war. So what Israel needs to do, and what I think the electorate was saying, we need to restore our deterrent. Our friends, our neighbors are not going to desist from attacking us out of love of us or out of gratitude for our concessions at the table. They will desist today as they had for almost 50 years because of the fear of an Israeli deterrent. And I think that's what Sharon's job is to do, to restore stability by means of a deterrent. Whether or not it would trigger a war is a question. But obviously he hopes not to. He hopes to calibrate the response
right,
enough to produce a decrease in the violence without triggering a war. That's hard to do, but that's his historic job.
Yeah, but that's what Barak tried to do, and he was accused of zigzagging. I mean, that's
Bernard Abishai, sorry.
That's the problem right there. The problem right there is that you can't have your cake and eat it. You can't say, yes, we have to respond much more powerfully to this challenge than Barak did, and not then use the kind of forces that become escalatory. That's the problem, and that and a great many Israelis who continue to back the peace process, even though they are deeply disappointed in the Palestinian response, know that.
Our guests have just described what the dilemma is very well and why there's no real prospect for a significant movement in the peace process in the next couple of years, I think. Because the fact is, it was a vote against the Barak government's policies, but it wasn't a vote in favor of any alternate coherent set of policies. It's not just deterrence that's going to keep the Palestinians from doing something violent. It's also the carrots as well as the sticks, the hope of something better, no more settlements, perhaps pulling back some of the settlements of their real autonomy. And unless that kind of package can be offered that has both, here's what happens if you don't comply, here's what happens if you do comply, there's no chance of going forward. Basically, I don't see any Palestinian government accepting anything less than Barak offered, and I don't at Camp David.
But Gideon, they didn't even accept what Barak offered, and
exactly,
they started
but that's
a war
the starting
as a
point.
Response. So how can you argue that carrots are what is needed when he threw at him a grocery store full of carrots and received in return the Katyusha rockets?
Well, the basic reason why Oslo broke down was because it wasn't clear that the Palestinians wanted a final end to the conflict, and to a smaller
degree.
It is clear.
They don't. I mean, it's not unclear at all. It's rather crystal clear.
Well,
it was precisely because the Israelis were pushing for an end to the conflict, an end to further claims, that the Palestinians said, you're crazy. We want this conflict to continue because we will not be satisfied with the half loaf.
That's your reading.
It's not entirely on the Arab side here. It's largely, but not entirely. It seems to me that you're not going to get a new round of the peace process until the Israelis are prepared to give up the settlements or at least stop their process forward and consolidate.
Barak offered 96% of the territories and compensation with territory in Israel proper for what was left over.
I'm not disagreeing with you in the sense that the peace process is not going to go forward because what Barak offered is the new minimum for the Arabs to come back to the table, and yet Sharon is nowhere going to go anywhere near that in terms of what he's prepared to offer. So even if he talks peace and wants to make an overture, there's not going to be any there because both sides' expectations have to be lowered dramatically before any kind of new round of peace talks can happen. That'll take violence. I don't think it'll be war, but it probably is a simmering violent conflict for the next couple of years, perhaps.
Bernie Avishai, do you want a word before we go to calls?
The only point I wanted to make is that on the one hand, it's been asserted, and I think we all agree, that wars can start accidentally. There has been a Palestinian uprising. Whether that was calculated in advance is very arguable. The vast majority of people who've suffered from this uprising have been Palestinians themselves who have been responding with tremendous rage. You know, one of the people who was killed in this, a Palestinian leader of Tanzin by the name of Tabet Tabet, was himself arguing in favor of peace. One of his own, his children, in fact, were born because his wife went to a Tel Aviv gynecologist at the urging of an Israeli friend. I mean, this is all much, much more complicated than simply saying, there's war, and it's something Arafat always wanted. It's not that simple.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Bush administration and the Sharon government connection, but 1-800-423-TALK. David is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, David.
Yes, hello. I have a two-part question going back in time, I guess, to September. First, what really was it that Sharon did when he visited the Temple Mount that seemed to trigger the latest round of uprisings? What about his particular visit was so upsetting? The other half of the question is, and I'm not really a conspiracy theorist, but apparently he's been fairly covetous of the prime minister position for quite a while. And do any of the people on the panel believe that this was really a potentially calculated move on his part to create a new round of unrest so that the Labour government would be put in a difficult position and therefore give him potentially a better shot at the office that he's just been elected?
David, it's a very thorny question, and it's argued hundreds of ways. Charles Krauthammer, do you want to take a short crack at Sharon's calculation here in going to the Temple Mount?
Sharon's calculation was simple. This came after Camp David, at which Barak had broken with 35 years of Israeli sort of national consensus by offering a division of Jerusalem and by equivocating on the Temple Mount, on Israeli control of the Temple Mount. And he did not, by the way, go into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as was implied in your introduction. He simply went on the Temple Mount itself, which, as you know, is...
I said to the... I didn't say he went in, and nobody ever did.
Yeah, he didn't. He just went on the... what's called the Noble Sanctuary, which is known to the Jews as the Temple Mount and is their holiest of holies, as a way of asserting that it was a sovereign Israeli territory. And as you know, he received the backing of the Prime Minister, Barak, at the time for that action.
He had the police. I'm not sure he had the backing.
I'm sorry?
He had the police. I'm not sure he had the backing.
Barak expressed repeatedly that what Sharon had done was not the a legitimate trigger for what had occurred, and that he had supported his going on the Temple Mount. Clearly, he cleared it with the Prime Minister. You don't walk up on the Mount with the police on your own. Secondly, the idea that it was some kind of calculated move, I think actually that's a very far-fetched notion. The idea at the time was to assert sovereignty. I think the Israelis were rather taken aback by the fact that it turned into the guerrilla war which has followed. And I think Arafat and some of his people, including Abu Mazen, have said explicitly in interviews that they, after Camp David, they were looking for some kind of provocation.
Hold it right there. David, that's one of many possible answers to your interesting question. We're talking about the new Middle East, the new Bush, the new Sharon governments. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, the man who may have discovered the cure...
offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection, talking about the Middle East at the start of the Bush 2, Sharon era. Should the Middle East be at the top of the Bush agenda? What is the risk of escalation? 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation with Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs, the columnist Charles Krauthammer, and the writer and business consultant Bernard Avishai. Maureen is on the line.
Good morning.
Welcome, Maureen.
Thank you. I was calling to ask what the concern of the panelists and what you think the administration's concern is on the part of the administration or the American public, insofar as public opinion in this country is concerned regarding the conflict. I don't have a scholarly knowledge of the area, and I consider myself both a friend of Israel and a friend of Jewish people, and I'm looking for the good in what's happening. And what I see, the images that I see on television, are of houses, Palestinian houses being bulldozed and Palestinian children being prevented from getting to school. And I'm looking for the good stuff. So I wonder what your panelists think for those of us who do not read Charles Krauthammer every day, or watch every single thing. What they're thinking is in terms of American public opinion about this.
Maureen, it's an interesting question. Gideon Rose, do you want to take a guess?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the reasons you see those images is you don't see footage of the Palestinian sharpshooters behind the rock-throwing kids, who are the ones that the Israeli fighters are actually shooting back at. So the media images are somewhat distorted. I don't think that public opinion in the U.S. is really going to be a major driving factor in Bush administration policy, because although there are small groups that care a great deal about this, particularly the pro-Israel forces in terms of being a politically significant group, there isn't particularly a clear policy, and it's not really a major benefit for the Bush administration to go any way on this. At this point, their chief concern will be not having whatever violence and conflict erupts in the territories and in Israel proper screw up the rest of the administration's foreign policy, and in particular its broader Middle East policy.
Anybody want to agree or disagree? I mean, how flexible, how patient, how engaged is the broad mass of American opinion?
Well, what's really interesting, if anybody who works as a columnist or in journalism, I'm sure you know, Christopher, it's very hard to get people interested in foreign affairs. They're far more interested in domestic affairs. If you look at the last three presidential elections, there was almost no discussion whatsoever of foreign affairs because of the calculation of these political experts, and they do win elections, that people are far less interested in anything else. So in a general atmosphere of non-interest in foreign affairs, particularly after the Cold War, you've got, as Gideon indicated, a few interested groups, particularly American Jews, interested in this issue. But it does not resonate. It is not an issue on which a politician would want to stake a lot of capital. I think he's absolutely right. The main interest of this administration is a kind of a negative one, that large bad things should not happen.
But it's the large...
Bernie Abishai.
Well, the large bad things are the only things you ever really see on television, obviously. The Intifada has given us images of a little boy being shot in his father's arms and a Palestinian with blood on his hands coming to the window looking manic. You know, those are the things that get reported. It's part of the tragedy we're in here. You know, I drove to the Hebrew University 48 hours ago and passed maybe 3,000 Palestinians on Route 1 up to the Hebrew University. You know, out of those 3,000 Arabs, only one probably might have even ever considered shooting at me. But in a process of escalation, you know, you start treating all 3,000 as if they're potentially shooters. And that's the kind of thing that we need a government not to fall victim to. They can't be suckers for it. We can't get into a situation where we lose the importance of stabilizing the situation so the 2,999 aren't sort of confused with the sniper. And that's
on
the other side. It's true on the other side as well. You know, I don't believe Ariel Sharon intended to provoke a war when he went to the Temple Mount. But I think the Palestinian reaction to seeing him and 1,000 police officers there was very important here. And the PLA was warning the Israeli government not to allow this thing to happen. Arafat was at Barak's home on the Monday night, at his home in Tel Aviv, on the Monday night before Sharon went to the Temple Mount, and pleaded with Barak not to let him go. So if he had some kind of long-term plan to provoke it, he certainly wasn't playing his card that Monday night.
1-800... Go ahead, Gideon.
I think we all agree the Bush administration doesn't want to get involved but doesn't want to see the situation spill over and escalate. And the question is how they're going to do that in practice. I think one thing they might do differently, interestingly enough, is to be more vocal in criticizing both sides. The Clinton administration, because it was trying to conciliate and trying to push the peace process forward, overlooked a lot of flagrant violations and unfortunate activities by both sides, the Arabs and the Israelis. And I think one thing the Bush administration might do is stop cutting them, each side, some slack. And if they disagree with something that either side is doing, they might call them on that. And I think that would be an interesting and salutary gesture.
1-800-423-8255 joins the Middle East Connection. In the Bush 2 Sharon era, Carl is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Carl.
Thank you for taking my call. I think that one has to discuss all these events in terms of a fundamental perspective. And that is to realize that the Palestinians and the Arab world in general, like public opinion all across the Arab world, has not accepted the existence of Israel, even to this day. And, of course, they make no bones about it in their media, calling for the destruction of Israel. And the Palestinian textbooks, of course.
You don't think Egypt accepts the existence of
Israel
or Jordan?
Well, you know, let's look at this. They recently had military maneuvers, and their putative enemy in these maneuvers was Israel. The Cairo, the newspapers all across Israel are, all across Egypt.
Carl, exactly what does that prove?
Huh?
What does that prove?
Well, it proves the obvious. Why do I have to belabor it? They keep saying that Israel and the Jews are monsters, to use one generic term to cover it all, and are deserving for nothing. Kill them wherever they are is the message. And, you know, it pays to start listening to it. There was an economic conference recently. All the nations met and they discussed all these things for a new Middle East, and not one word of Israel was mentioned. No map of Israel was presented. There's no map of Israel.
Carl, I know there are a lot of nutty people out there saying crazy things, but where did you last hear that from an Arab government?
Terry, but I keep track because I stay informed. And the fact is that these are things that are going on continuously. And, of course, you know, the last time that NPR itself was challenged on this matter, Linda Gradstein was reported to say that she didn't consider all these things of calling for the death of the Jews as even worth reporting.
Now, Chris, I think the real issue here...
Go ahead.
Chris, I think the real issue here is not so much that there is a huge outpouring of love and affection for Israel from any of the Arab states or from the Palestinians, but rather even if some of what the caller is saying is true, what then do you do if you are Israel and you are still living with a population that is essentially a subject population of a very large percentage of your territory and a large percentage of your overall population? What do you do about it? Are you going to keep them subject forever, or are you going to have apartheid, or what?
Yeah,
the whole point of Oslo is some kind of attempt to essentially end that part of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And the reason everyone keeps coming back to it, and why we almost certainly will come back to some variation of it a few months or probably years down the road, is because there is no other alternative to some kind of compromise in which the Palestinians get some kind of autonomy and independence in their land, and Israel gets some kind of peace.
Look, the whole point of Oslo was that there would be an interim period during which you would have a lessening of tensions, an increase in understanding and tolerance, leading to a situation in which a solution might be possible. Now, what happened over the 7 years is while Israel withdrew, while Israel granted autonomy and essential independence, while Israel withdrew its occupation, 99% of Palestinians in the territories are living under Arafat's control and not Israel's control. While all of that was happening, the media and the pedagogy under the control of Arafat became far more vitriolic than it ever has been. The anti-Semitism, apart from the anti-Zionism, of the Palestinian media is notorious and very publicly known, in addition, as the caller indicated, to the Egyptian media. And what you have is Arafat raising a generation on hate. And that was precisely the opposite of what was expected by this interim period. The interim period was supposed to be a period in which each side accommodated. The Israelis, on the other hand, have had leaders, Likud and Labor, who have been preparing the population for concessions. You've had changes in the textbooks. You had a documentary series on Israel TV on the 50th anniversary, which was remarkably sympathetic to Palestinian concerns. And on the other hand, you have had pedagogy and propaganda from the media controlled by Arafat, which have been absolutely disgraceful and astonishing. And as a result, what you have is a generation of kids raised to hate. And you see that today in the streets.
I just want to remind everyone that that same program that was on Israeli television was exactly on Palestinian television. Palestinian media and Israeli media are completely interwoven. People see everything that's on Palestinian television and vice versa. This is not some little controlled 1984 community. This is a world that is increasingly integrated in the world of Israeli political democracy.
Who writes the children's textbooks?
Wait, look, I'm not denying that there have been people demonizing
the
others.
It's not people. I'm talking about the authorities. I'm not talking about the odd lunatic.
Charlie, all I'm trying to say here is that the Palestinians, if anything, have had an education in political democracy coming directly from Israeli media. If you talk to people in the Palestinian elites, they feel far more understanding and appreciative of political democracy precisely because they've been part of this process. The problem with Oslo has been not that the Palestinians have somehow controlled the thoughts and minds of Palestinians. The problem with the Oslo process is the vast majority of people who were supposed to be drawn into a confidence-building period through economic progress and so on have actually been in a situation where their economic lives have deteriorated. Gaza is worse than a third-world country today. People are not enjoying anything like the fruits of peace that were offered them or promised them back in 1992. And all the while, Barak, partly I think because he was so certain that he was going to take the world to a peace process, was actually allowing for the thickening of Israeli settlements, the expansion of Israeli settlements on the West Bank. And the Palestinians, the vast majority of Palestinians on the street, saw a Palestinian government that was increasingly corrupt. They saw that the economic gains of Oslo were not there, and they exploded.
If you talk to Dennis Ross, who is hardly a prejudiced observer of this situation, he will emphasize, and he has time and again, that one of the great failings of Oslo was that what he calls sort of the socialization to peace on the part of the Palestinians never occurred, and in fact, the very opposite happened. What you had is as soon as the instruments of information, either textbooks, newspapers, media, TV, radio, fell into the hands of the PLO when it came in at the beginning of Oslo, it became an instrument for the most vitriolic, hateful propaganda. And when you raise children on that, you get consequences. And you see that the consequences today in the streets.
Charles Krauthammer, thank you. We'll leave it there. There's a lot more to talk about. We didn't really get to Ariel Sharon's ambition to be the Charles de Gaulle in this situation, maybe even the Nixon to China that's reflected in Bill Safire's column this morning. Let's talk about it again. Thank you, Gideon Rose, Charles Krauthammer, Bernard Avishai. Connection listeners, you can continue the Sharon Bush 2 conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.